Welcome to episode 3 of the Tech Gen Mag podcast, bringing you the latest news in tech, science, and space. I'm your host, Christian Marcus, and today we're going to be talking with aerospace engineer Brian Kirkpatrick about the history, impact, and future of algorithms. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you. Where to begin? The algorithms themselves are simply ways of solving problems. Mm-hmm. So no matter what problem you have, if you find a methodical way to approach solving that problem or that class of problems, then you have an algorithm. Most of the references to algorithms we see nowadays are specific to computer programming and computer science. And that's for good reason, because in computer science, you're able to group and classify a lot of really complicated problems in interesting ways, and then you can solve those ways directly using computer code or some analogy thereof within the scientific community. But at a more abstract sense, algorithms have been around as long as people have been trying to solve problems. So there's a Babylonian tablet, for example, that we have from 1700 BC.
Wow.
That goes through an algorithm to compute the square root of 2, which is an irrational number, so it goes on forever. And they came up with a way to compute this out to many decimal points that was very interesting and actually very efficient. So that, I think, is one of the earliest examples of an algorithm, if you will. If we talk about the history, probably the next biggest development in algorithms, if you will, was Euclid's development of a school of geometry. And that was very rigorous. It laid out foundations for a lot of the mathematics we have nowadays. And then we'd fast forward maybe 1,000 more years to sort of the first programmer who's, I don't know if you're familiar with Ada Lovelace. She worked with Charles Babbage, who was one of the first developers of thinking machines or computing machinery. And she was the one who sat down and actually wrote out instructions for solving problems. And this was early 1800s. Many people consider her to be the first programmer, and it's certainly the first example of what most people today would think of as an algorithm. Step-by-step, methodical calculations of how to solve a particular problem in a sort of numerical sense of explicit instructions that you might find in a computer language.
So then these are mathematically driven programs that, in a sense, independently seek out, execute functions based on the parameters that someone sets? Is that kind of a way to understand it?
You could certainly think of it that way. In the sense of computer programs, you have explicit instructions, but you can always have an algorithm that's simply a way to tackle something that you don't know how to solve. So the analogy I like to use is a cookbook. In a cookbook, you have many recipes. Mm. And those recipes are a bit like algorithms. They tell you, the programmer or the user or the cook, like, this is how you might approach making this particular dish. Mm. And how you implement that algorithm, how you actually cook it or cook the dish, or how you actually program the code and what steps you do, may be like that. They may be a little bit different. You may have to adapt it to your particular circumstances. But underlying a lot of problems that we try to solve, both in computer science and in general as intelligent humans, we can abstract to that level of here's a general way of approaching this kind of problem and how you might solve it.
So what I understand is current or maybe previous versions of algorithms are kind of limited to, like you said, it's a certain recipe that they have to follow and then execute. But are algorithms currently being directed where they can actually independently adapt on their own? Or are they still kind of just dependent on how they're initially created?
So we'll confine the scope for the sake of this conversation, this question, to the field of computer science, if you will. If an algorithm is like a set of code, then for the most part, when we think about algorithms as code, those are static. They're unchanging. You give it like a problem or a set of numbers and it will come up with a solution of some kind. That having been said, there's a lot of interesting research, and the idea has been around for a few decades now, of algorithms that can modify themselves in an attempt to pursue a solution, particularly in an attempt to like optimize a particular solution or search a particular space and continually modify how you search the space or how you're looking for something. We haven't seen anything, obviously, that is completely independently intelligent, and Skynet's not going to happen anytime soon. But we do have concepts, and they're called sometimes genetic algorithms, that are able to modify themselves in pursuit of finding a solution.
I see. So what is this? I've been hearing a lot about machine learning. This seems to be like a trendy program language that's being developed. So what exactly is machine learning, and how does it differ from algorithm? Are the two somewhat related?
Oh, they're very much related. Machine learning is a concept in which you have a process that is able to take examples of things that have either been solved or, you know, basically data sets from stuff that's already been performed either by itself or input into it by a user. And it takes those examples and it simply learns from them to figure out how to better solve those kinds of problems in the future. So they're not necessarily self-evolving, but they are adaptive. Mm-hmm. But it's not necessarily a programming language so much as a way to build a problem that you don't 100% know how to solve the best way yet.
Mm-hmm.
That's one way to think about it. You can then have some sort of a process that will learn as it goes or can take what other things have learned in the past, other data sets, and look at those data sets and maybe extrapolate ways to solve problems it hasn't seen yet.
So let's talk about some of the application, the uses of algorithms currently. So we hear a lot about, Facebook is using algorithms to, you know, track and record information it's gathering from its users, which it then sells to other companies, or it uses to kind of target or provide information to, you know, companies who want to better target their audiences. So talk a little bit about that.
So a lot of the contexts in which we hear algorithms used nowadays are the computer science-y sort of startup and software applications. Facebook is one example, Google's another. A lot of these software startups have some particular kind of algorithm that they're using for a particular application.
Mm-hmm.
Google is probably the best example in terms of the company that's been able to capitalize on a particular algorithm. They were able to figure out a really good way to index the internet, which the internet's pretty big. They can help you find stuff really quickly, really easy, obviously, and they have an algorithm for doing that. It's very useful, and they've been able to market it very well. They figured out a good way to do that. Facebook has been able to develop some algorithms in support of its mission or its business plan, if you will. But Facebook itself is not necessarily built around algorithms the same way Google is. They will use them to do what they're trying to do, but Facebook is more of a data-centric environment. So you see data or pictures, videos, et cetera, posts that other people make. Other people see you're associated with your profile and other people's profiles and groups, et cetera. And what Facebook then does is they'll use that information to target ads. They'll say to advertisements, if you go and say, hey, Facebook, buy $100 worth of advertisements, and this is something anybody can do. One of the things you'll do in that process is they'll give you a form that says, okay, who do you want to target? And unlike Google, where you have to give them just keywords and sort of predict what people are going to search for, with Facebook, you specifically say, you know, in this form, I want to target males between the ages 23 and 27 who are living in the Pacific Northwest and who have expressed an interest in biking.
Right.
So that has a very great value to marketers because they're no longer wasting their money on reaching people who they're not trying to target. Now they can really focus on someone who or a group who is going to give them a really good return on their investment. So I guess if that could be considered an algorithm, that is being able to target a particular market, that might be the Facebook algorithm. But really it's more about how they're managing all this data that people have given them in a way to help other people fulfill their business models.
So an algorithm really is key to this. And when you look at the history of marketing or advertising, you know, they've always they've always conducted research. They've already done pilot studies of, you know, what does the population think about our products? Mm-hmm. But algorithms really just opens the field. I mean, it really just broadens just the target audience and just the access to the information that's out there.
Absolutely, especially if you look in, if we can continue using Facebook as an example, especially if you look at the way in which Facebook has grown.
Mm-hmm.
So they may not have needed to think a lot about, on the Google level of computer science, what's the best way to develop this formula for searching something, for example. But as they've grown to millions and tens of millions, and I think it may be hundreds of millions of users, now they have so much data. It's like a little internet all of its own. And I use the word literal relative or little relatively here, of course. But their biggest problem now is they have all this data and this huge universe in their hands. And they need to figure out a way to continue using it effectively and continue to make money off. So when they use algorithms now, it's trying to figure out, well, someone's trying to, you know, search their messages that they've sent. And they have many data centers of billions of messages.
Wow.
Someone's trying to find one message. That's an incredibly complicated problem. Whereas Google has everything indexed already, even though it's internet, it's just pages, not necessarily, you know, what attributes of someone's favorite pet monkey are. Facebook, in a sense, has a bigger challenge because that's not necessarily part of their ethos. That having been said, they've seen that problem. And they're adapting to tackle it. They're no longer running PHP, which is like the script kiddie version of internet languages.
Yeah. So Google, they index like websites and pages. Mm-hmm. So that's one layer that they have to develop algorithms for. Mm-hmm. And then there's, I'm assuming there's other layers. Then below the web page searches, you have the actual content and the, you know, the text that's embedded within the content of the websites and pages. Whereas Facebook is not, it's not indexing web pages necessarily, but like, as you said, all the pieces of information, the messages, the images, you know, the likes and the shares
sure.
that users, I guess, engage in. So that presents different problems.
Absolutely. And because Facebook has been so profitable in organizing information and marketing information the way they have, Google has seen this, and Google's not stupid.
Mm.
They're trying to do very much the same thing.
With Google Plus.
It's not just a matter of, here's our social network, Google Plus, here's their social network.
Yeah.
Google sees every bit of data in the world as something that they can potentially catalog and organize and help you find and utilize. And it's very altruistic of them, if you will. One of their mottos, of course, is do no evil.
Right.
They really see this as a mission, at least at the sort of ideological sense, of being able to give everybody in the world access to everybody's information.
Mm-hmm.
So they used to be just pages, if you will. They since expanded their scope. So they don't just have Google Plus now. They're organizing the world's videos, if you will, with YouTube.
Wow.
They're organizing the world's pictures with Picasa. And Google Plus ends up being more like the central way that to have a continuous profile across all of these things. So YouTube is basically the videos section of Google Plus now.
Yeah.
Picasa is basically the photos section of Google Plus, et cetera. Google's expanding their ability to index and search all this information beyond just the page sense.
And then not just accessing Google through like desktops and, you know, tablets and cell, but now it's expanding into cell phones and tablets.
It's more information for people to have access for. And nowadays, the mindset, certainly in the Silicon Valley environment, is more information is more things that can be used, either for marketing or for developing plans or whatever application is. Information now has so much more of a value because so many companies have been able to demonstrate ways that it can be used to make profit.
Really, the scale of the information that they have access to, and looking even farther into the future, we're talking about the Internet of Things. So as I understand it, Internet of Things involves not just the information that we willingly give an input into a social media platform, whether it's YouTube or Facebook or Google Plus or Picasa, but rather, you know, the items that we actually purchase and to what extent we're wearing these items or using these products. So implanting chips in, you know, whether it's a t-shirt or a pair of shoes or, I don't know, just any product. I mean, is that kind of the direction it's kind of going, or?
That's one application. Typically, when you hear the term Internet of Things, what people are talking about are anything, devices, light bulbs, thermostats, t-shirts, anything that can is now connected to the Internet. It's now, you know, it has its address on the Internet and it can receive instructions. It can provide data to people with appropriate access. So now you can control your thermostat at home from your smartphone, for example. That's an example of the Internet of Things.
So it's an interactive in nature as well, not just...
It's an attempt to sort of maximize everything that is connected to the Internet.
Gotcha,
So it's no longer just computers and smartphones. It's everything
like
that...
smart TVs, smart refrigerators, smart microwaves.
That's the Internet of Things.
Yeah. And would that also feed into the information that some companies might see?
Oh, you know it will. So that's, in a large sense, that's one of the main driving forces behind a lot of these things. Let's use the refrigerator example. If you have a refrigerator, one that's a smart refrigerator, one of the advantages that people try to pitch for smart refrigerators is, well, now you will never have to worry about running out of food because your refrigerator will notice when you're running low on vegetables. And it will send you a message or it will place an order with Amazon Prime or Amazon Fresh saying, well, let's, you know, I know this person has ordered corn a lot lately and beans and spinach. So we're running out of corn, beans, and spinach. I'm going to place a new order for another week's worth of these vegetables.
Yeah.
So for a consumer, you know, that can be very convenient. But now someone who has access to that information, not necessarily in a nefarious sense, but from a marketing sense, is now going to send you advertisements about, hey, our corn's amazing. You should buy our corn. Or try these beans. Or did you know there was a coli spinach epidemic from this? You know, you shouldn't buy that. You should buy our stuff.
So alerts and notices and that, you know, being...
Exactly. It comes down to another way that people can utilize information that they have access to.
Going in this direction, it's almost like there'll be increased automation in the sense that I can see a world where, for example, with the smart refrigerator, instead of having to go out and shop on a weekly basis, which I think a lot of people are finding increasingly burdensome given how much, you know, we're all working these days. I can see where, oh, the fridge can sense that you're low on X amount of X and Y, Z. So it'll send a notice to some grocery shopping agency that kind of goes out and, you know, supplies you.
Absolutely.
So you don't even have to go to the store. You just input what kinds of foods, you know, you typically want. And as soon as the fridge senses that you're running low on those supplies, it sends an alert to the grocery delivering mm-hmm. business.
Yep.
And then, boom, automatically they supply you. And it just kind of shows up.
In fact, that link that I mentioned between smart refrigerators and Amazon Fresh in particular,
I think is
one that's inevitable. That's
right.
That's going to Amazon being the, you know, it has a new smartphone that's trying to get itself into everything now.
Wow.
I suspect you'll see Amazon selling smart refrigerators that are automatically plugged into Amazon Fresh any second if they haven't already.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's really amazing. So this really comes up with the idea of internet privacy. I mean, is the era of information privacy over? I mean, are people just willingly giving it up in exchange for the benefits that putting this information out there can return?
People have willingly been giving it up for many years now, really ever since Facebook, if you will.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the bad boy everyone likes to blame, but everyone nowadays is trying to use data in some way or another. I think we're not necessarily at a place where there will be no more internet privacy. I think we're in a place where people, consumers in particular, are becoming more and more aware of the ways that their data is being used. And as a result, they're insisting on more and better ways that they can control that information. I think consumers are realists. I think they know they have, I mean, they're practical. If nothing else, consumers are very practical. They know that they're getting something, this information. They're getting free movies. They're getting free YouTube clips. They're getting free services all the time from a large number of these companies. They know that what they're giving in exchange for those free things is typically either their time, you know, watching an ad or the information they're giving up. And I think instead what we'll see is a push or an insistence on better ways to manage what data you do release. So personally, you've probably picked this up by now. I'm not a huge fan of Facebook, and that's mainly because they have a very bad track record of letting users control what information they release. Sure, you can set up a profile on a social network, and some companies are better than others about how easily they hand that information over. But in Facebook's history, every 6 or 9 months or so, they'll reset all privacy settings, and they won't tell you.
Right, they do that very quietly.
Settings, and now, since when could people see what my favorite vegetables are? I swear I blocked that a few months ago. Well, Mark Zuckerberg's decided that he's going to make more money.
Because when they change it, it's like
an
automatic default. Like, unless you go in and change it.
That's one of the big reasons. Not necessarily the information sharing, but the lack of control over what you can and can't share. That I actually don't use Facebook anymore. I'm 100% Google Plus, man.
I like how you mentioned that. I mean, consumers are savvy, and they're becoming smarter to the fact that, our information is being used. And I've even seen... I mean, I barely use Facebook. I mean, I have one for my website, obviously, but in terms of me interacting or using it to interact with other people, I just don't really do it that much. But what I have noticed among many of my friends who do use Facebook is it's no longer an authentic, it's no longer, I guess, an innocent extension of their day-to-day activities and their thoughts and opinions, but rather they're actually controlling, like they're actually working to create this image, this persona of themselves.
So in a sense, it's really become another internet.
Yeah.
Because before it was very open. It was novel, if you will. It was a bit of a novelty.
Mm-hmm.
It was very honest because it's just, you know, it was basically like a yearbook. That's how the idea started. You're staying in touch with your friends,
right,
et cetera. And now, like any other social network or any other place on the internet, you try to develop these personalities. You try to build this front, this facade. And sort of market yourself, if you will. And that speaks to, you know, there's lots of tangents you could go off into about why that is and what psychological human traits are
it's
that drive that decision.
One of my bachelor's is sociology. If I ever thought about continuing on, that would be an area that I'd be interested in, is how has, you know, social media platforms impacted and just the psychology and the mindset of its users. It's kind of really fascinating. I'm sure it's already being studied exhaustively, but it's definitely a fascinating field.
And it's not just social networks. I'd say that it's the internet in general. Let me see if I can find something here. There's a comic called Penny Arcade, and they had a commentary a few years ago that was the theory of internetness, like what happens when people go on the internet and suddenly they're anonymous. And it can be a completely normal, you know, 9-to-5, normal person just very pleasant, and then suddenly they become anonymous, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they have complete control right. over whatever that is, and that anonymity just turns them into complete.
Oh yeah, yeah.
F-tar.
I'm just look at any of the commentary
exactly.
Section, and it's just
YouTube
yeah.
comments.
Oh my gosh, it's terrible. It can be here, vicious, here downright vicious.
There's the specific. I don't know if you have to pay royalties if yeah. I mention this or something, but the specific normal person plus anonymity plus audience. I guess that's a key factor. Plus the audience
mm-hmm.
equals what's the rating level here?
Yeah.
Oh well, total FWOD.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no rain here. You can say whatever
okay.
you want. Yeah. yeah, and here's another thing on this topic. There's a kind of an internet futurist. He's the one who actually first coined virtual reality, okay. Jaron Lanier. And he recently wrote a book called Who Owns the Future? And he talks about how, according to him, in some way the middle class has actually been disenfranchised because they're not companies are profiting off them and they have no financial stake in this exchange. And he actually envisions a system where users are actually paid for their likes and for their use
well, they're
of
right,
the social
we?
Media. Yeah.
And, there's a game I love to play called League of Legends.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh,
if
yes,
you go
yes.
to the League of Legends Facebook page and like their page, you get a free skin for one of the characters you can play.
So they are doing
and that's a very minor example.
Yeah.
Sure. But there's already ways that people are seeking to
yeah.
leverage that. And I don't think that's too surprising.
Yeah. But, you know, if companies are using your information and they're mm-hmm. profiting of it, should users themselves in some way get some kind of kickback?
It depends on the user.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of companies have already come to the realization, and this isn't too unheard of in the marketing community at least, that there are some users who are followers and there are some users who are leaders in terms of adoption.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the gold nuggets, if you will, in marketing community is finding and getting into the mind of the first adopters, the first wave of people who pick mm-hmm. things up and make them popular.
Yeah.
So you may be familiar with the radio personality, Neil Peart, for example.
Mm-hmm.
He's fairly good at avoiding being marketed, but he's a valuable person in the sense of he is sort of the access point that a lot of people in sort of the common market are able to hear about new technology and new developments. And so instead of marketing to 10,000 people, you could try to market to one person and have your message magnified in that sense. But that one person will get a free laptop or something. If you go to a convention, you see a lot of that.
Yeah.
The same, the press is treated like royalty, obviously.
Oh,
if
yeah.
If you go to like
yeah.
E3, I saw your
I did. I went to
June.
That was so much fun.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That was so,
so
cool.
So people want you to say good things about
yeah.
their stuff. Right?
Of course.
So
we got free lunches and
oh, yeah.
all kinds. It was cool.
I don't think it's anything anyone hasn't seen mm-hmm. before. I think we're just seeing the same phenomenon adapting and evolving to mm-hmm. a new environment, which isn't too surprising.
Yeah. It's really exciting times and things are just changing so rapidly and
the more they change,
yeah.
you know the same.
So well anyways, I think we've had about 25 minutes and I think that was we covered a little bit of everything.
Yeah, I think we've been a little beyond algorithms at the end, but that's fine. It's a
no,
fun
I mean yeah, it's just kinda snowballed. Yeah, snowballed into all kinds of things. So I definitely appreciate your time and you know, I look forward to having future discussions.
I'd love to.
So, all right. Thanks for listening. And don't forget to check out our website at www.techgenmag.com, bringing you the latest news in tech, science, and space.